When students go back to school every fall, it takes a while to get them back up to speed and learning again. It's called a summer slide. Now a group of school librarians are worried about a larger gap this year and are ready to help.
The school library is the largest classroom in the school.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the fight against COVID slide. We'll also hear research on the effect of spring break on the coronavirus pandemic and spend an academic minute changing the world with birds. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Summer slide happens every year. When students return to school, they lost just a bit of their learning momentum over vacation, and they need to crank it up again. This year, educators are worried about a much larger COVID slide, since students have been out of school much longer. One group of educators gearing up for this challenge is school librarians. John Kraska is the executive director of the Every Library Institute, a nonprofit that works to strengthen school libraries and librarians in the U.S. They recently published a white paper report called School Librarians and the COVID Slide. I spoke with Kraska about the role school librarians play in education and why he believes this year's summer slide will be worse than usual.
Well, picture the start of summer and then the beginning of school with a slide, a decline. Maybe it's 30% for reading or as much as 50% for mathematics. That starts, you know, right around Memorial Day in many places and goes all the way to Labor Day. And that's 30%. Well, what if we back it up to the middle of March when the shutdowns had to happen and that rapid shift from in-person classrooms to digital and a very uneven uptake of success for digital in many schools, unfortunately. If that slide starts, you know, back in the middle of March instead of at the beginning of June, it's a lot longer time to slide. And that COVID slide is something that's concerning educators around the country and even around the world. How do we fill in the gaps? How do we try and arrest or even reverse that very significant slide? And if this persists for a while, which it very well may, how do we build new systems that will help student achievement and families and other educators as well?
And why is this of particular interest to school librarians?
School librarians do two things with students all the time. And in a disrupted environment like it is during COVID, in a shift to hybrid learning or all digital or even back to all in-person with social distancing, school librarians support as co-teachers and as individual teachers the curriculum. So they are invested heavily across the curriculum in helping students achieve and succeed. And then the other thing that they do is help individualize learning. And the one kid, not just a pullout for special attention, but what do you want to discover today? What do you want to read about for some fun and for some joy? So we are invested not only in seeing the curriculum realized and the goals of education in districts and schools all around the country come to fruition, but each and every student. The metaphor that's used all the time is that the school library is the largest classroom in the school. And that largest classroom brings every kid through at least, well, if you have a school library, once a week, perhaps even once a day. The extra gains that you get from a support system that helps teachers teach better and for those individual kids to discover and to learn and even some joy.
How many schools don't have librarians just off the top of your head?
About 20% right now around the country, but many of the schools that do not have school librarians are in Title I or communities that are lower income. And what we see is that not having that instructional support from school librarian and the support for study skills and information literacy amplifies some of those inequities, unfortunately. We see that there's a significant turnaround that can happen in a school when there is, yes, a reading specialist, yes, a technology specialist, but when you also have alongside or in addition or instead of those positions a school librarian, you have a utility infielder who can really put it to work, you know, for the school.
Do school libraries play a role in making distance learning possible?
Absolutely. Information literacy is one of the key things that school librarians focus on. It's how do you evaluate resources? How do you use resources, whether it's a traditional book or a database through the library? The skills that you need in order to interrogate information and put it to work in your studies are more important than ever in a distance education setting. Likewise, the school librarians are highly qualified to help with the very rapid shift and the ongoing need to move into digital. The resources are different in some cases. It's not just a simulacrum of a paper book. And to help the other teachers utilize those distance education resources better, school librarians are a key partner. Help families understand what their kids are using when it isn't a traditional book or it isn't a one-to-one device anymore. And to help the administration plan ahead for success during a time when things might be open and closed and opened again. School librarians are vital during the distance education shift because of what they bring as educators and evaluators, but also what they teach people to evaluate themselves.
With a lot of school districts, I'd even say most school districts around the country having budget issues because of the pandemic, are school libraries an easy target for cuts?
Unfortunately, the administrators don't always know what assets they have. School libraries and school librarian positions are sometimes targeted, which is truly unfortunate, something that we work against at every library and the Every Library Institute, because there are times when the school librarian, if you cut the school librarian, you cut the entire program. We don't want to see that happen. You cut an English teacher, you still have an English program. You cut a social studies teacher, you still have a social studies program. But a cut to the school librarian position, certified school librarian who's properly trained and equipped to help students of all different levels, you cut that position, you end up accidentally sometimes cutting an entire program, which is detrimental long-term for schools with their test scores, with student achievement, with the goals of individualized learning, and really the whole life of the child.
You've been involved, of course, for years with school libraries. How have you seen the role of that librarian evolve over the past 10, 20 years?
They've become, in a certain respect, the CIO, the Chief Information Officer for the schools that they're in. They have been tasked with and have really responded to the need to move from their traditional work of evaluating print material into evaluating online, digital, virtual materials. The format shift has changed. Their core competencies, though, have remained the same. They are very good at taking apart a text, a resource, a database, and helping adapt it to the learning outcomes that are the expected and hoped for ones for that district. What I've also seen, though, is the school librarians have become much more technology gateways for their school districts, whether it's a maker space and some of the 3D printing technologies and other fabrication tools that help kids not only discover and learn across the curriculum, but also start to envision career pathways. And we've seen a lot of school librarians adopting a real focus on, well, helping kids be entrepreneurial. And I don't mean just for business, so that's really important, but also entrepreneurial in their studies. 15, 25 years ago, you might not have seen that coming out of the school librarian. Now, it's a vital component of teaching not just across the curriculum, but for what happens after graduation day.
Do school librarians and the library programs in districts, do they have a connection with municipal public libraries?
They do and they don't. It depends on where you are. One of the key elements of what a public library does is tries to address some of that summer slide that we were talking about earlier. Summer reading programs are extremely key. And a lot of points of intersection pre-COVID have been around the handoff in April, May, or June to summer reading. And then the pick back up after summer reading's over in August and September, and the momentum that's focused on the success of those kids. During COVID, we're seeing some very innovative programs that are now kind of cutting across the traditional public library, school library, well, not divide, they're all in it together, but the differences. We're seeing a lot of cooperation now about access to collections. The public library perhaps had a better ebook collection than the school library did pre-COVID. How do we get interoperability between the school identification, you know, the school ID and the public library card? There's some really strong collaborations that are coming forward, and we're very excited to see that.
Well, we talked about how libraries have evolved till now. Let's look in that crystal ball. What do you see the school librarian's job in 5-10 years once we get past what we're doing right now?
Sure. I think we learn from what we're doing right now, which is to be able to take times of disruption and put our best thinking forward. Where school librarianship is going is around, I think, where we see education going, more and more focus on the individual student and less on the test. And I think that school librarians are ideally suited for that individualized learning focus, not just because they have the entire catalog of everything that's ever been produced, whether it's a book, an ebook, a database, video, audio, music. They also have all the tools for creation that can come into a campus. Individualized learning is where I think that education is going at the K-12 and the higher ed level as well. And that school librarians are there to empower individuals, families, and students to succeed in that kind of environment.
All right. The report, the white paper report on the COVID slide, who did that report and where did they look?
My colleague, Allison Mackley, from Pennsylvania. She is a board-certified school librarian and has a fantastic pedigree both as a school librarian herself in a classroom and then on the boards and commissions that she serves at the state and national level. She was the lead. I had the pleasure of being her co-author on that. The references on it are rather extensive. School librarians in the COVID slide white paper was a deep dive into current literature on topics like the summer slide learning loss, literature reviews of why school library programs and school librarians matter, and an overlay of information from the Department of Ed and several other national education associations about how student learning outcomes, educator effectiveness, and parent satisfaction all align around the work that's being done by school librarians.
Well, finally, I'm going to make you the king of the world right now. What does your ideal school library look like in a few years?
So my ideal school library in a few years is staffed by a certified school librarian who has some support from the administration for an aide or a clerk to handle some of the administration, because what's happening there is co-creation amongst the students and the school librarian on their own future. She or he is already a co-teacher with other parts of the faculty across English and social studies and math and sciences, but then the co-creation that happens when a student is empowered to make learning decisions on their own and is empowered with a collection that supports the curriculum as well as individualized study. That collection could be a book, an ebook, music, movies. It could also be some of the physical collection. That Internet of Things that we're starting to develop for our homes is going to be in the schools. And that next generation of manufacturing and of fabrication through 3D printing and other makerspaces is going to be in the schools. A couple years from now, I'd like to see that the school librarian at the nexus of that, where there's a proper funding formula to support those kids, whether we're talking about a Title I school or if the zip code lottery puts you in someplace much more wealthy. What I'd like every parent to know is that the school librarian, if there is one at your school, is ready and willing to help during this very significant time of disruption. They have an insight into what the learning outcomes are supposed to be, how the curriculum is supposed to go, and they have resources that you might not have seen on day one of the syllabus. If you as a parent need some help understanding what your kids are going through as well, what they should be doing or what they could be doing, the school librarian, if your school has one, is a key resource. And if you don't have one, this is a time to start talking to principals and superintendents and school boards about one of the best solutions to some of the education challenges out there, which is a school librarian who's got the largest classroom in the school open for business, digitally or in person.
John Kraska is the executive director of the Every Library Institute. Still to come, this spring, college students left for spring break and came back with coronavirus. That story's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A lot of us saw pictures of college students on spring break this year packing beaches and other tourist spots with no thought of social distancing, let alone masks. The result? A surge of coronavirus cases that they shared when they returned to class. That's one of the findings of a new survey by researchers at Ball State University and Vanderbilt University called College Student Contribution to Local COVID-19 Spread, Evidence from University Spring Break Timing. To learn more about this study, I spoke with one of the authors. Paul Niekamp is an assistant professor of economics in the Miller College of Business at Ball State. I asked Dr. Niekamp when they decided to take on this study.
So I think I saw this in early March. So in early March, if we can recall early March, I know there's a lot of movement in news and everything that's happened over the last few months. But in early March, there was one news release that really caught my eye, which was a student who was interviewed by CBS News and responded on air, "If I get corona, I get corona. At the end of the day, I'm not going to let it stop me from partying." So this was a student who was on spring break, and news agencies across the U.S. and even internationally were worried about what would happen if these students go on spring break and they come back to the universities, and what kind of impact would they have on the evolution of COVID-19 spread in the United States. So I saw this, and I thought, well, this is something that I can research. Like, this is something that my co-author and I, co-author is Daniel Mangrum from Vanderbilt University, and this is something that we could research. So we went about and we collected spring break dates from over 1,300 traditional four-year universities. And with these dates, we could look at which of these universities actually had their spring breaks and which ones effectively had theirs canceled. Because around March 10th, most universities had to cancel their spring breaks because most of them canceled their in-person classes. So you had some universities where students could go in spring break and some universities where students could not. And using some statistical procedures, we were able to estimate the causal effect of students going on spring break on COVID-19 spread in their local counties.
Well, just as an aside, I work at the University of West Florida campus, and everyone went out for spring break and just never came back. I'm sure that happened a lot.
Yes, that happened to a lot of schools. You know, these university spring breaks, they're determined years in advance by academic calendars. So you have some schools that have very early spring breaks. So students went on spring break, they came back to the university, stayed for a few days, maybe a couple weeks at some of the earliest, and then they went home. And then you had some who went on spring break and found out that their in-person classes were canceled, and then they went to their true home, not back to the university home. And then you had some students who just had their in-person classes canceled, and they didn't get to go on spring break, and they just went home.
How are you and your fellow author able to get this much information this soon?
Well, I think we're quite fortunate in that it's easy to track down. It takes some time, but it's easy to track down spring break dates for universities across the U.S. Then we had to pair that with COVID-19 data, which luckily is readily accessible at the county level. And then there's also Safegraph Incorporated. Safegraph is a company that uses cell phone application data. We're very grateful to Safegraph because they allowed researchers across the U.S. who are studying COVID-19 to have access to their data, which allows researchers to trace students, or more than students, to trace individuals over time using cell phone location data. So they essentially released this data almost real time so that we were able to access data in a timely manner.
Well, we've kept people in suspense. What did you find?
So what we found was that, hopefully this isn't too surprising, but it is in line with maybe people's expectations, that yes, students who went on spring break did indeed bring coronavirus back to their local counties. So students went on spring break, they came back, and then either they tested positive, so we find a bump up, an increase in COVID-19 spread growth rates the week that they return, and then we also find a lagged increase over the next couple weeks. So we see an increase, first a primary increase in COVID-19 spread, so that would be the students themselves testing positive, but there's also that extra impact are these students passing on COVID-19 to potentially high-risk individuals? And this is important because this is something that we've seen and that Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, even President Trump are talking about, which is that we have these young individuals who themselves are very low risk of mortality. But people are really concerned about who do these students pass COVID-19 to? So when they come back to the county or their university, they have the potential to pass COVID-19 on to older individuals in their social network or to older professors. So you have high-risk individuals that are particularly important to study. So we also look at COVID-19-related mortality, and we do find a lagged increase or evidence of a lagged increase in COVID-19 mortality 4 to 5 weeks after these students return. I think it's important to say that spring break and university student travel does contribute to local COVID-19 spread in the counties of universities. And this is something that universities need to take into consideration, that they might have low-risk students who might not be harmed too much themselves by COVID-19 by being infected, but these students do have the possibility of passing on COVID-19 to higher-risk individuals. And these universities might want to take this into consideration when determining their academic calendars this fall or other actions in the ways that they will actually roll out education this fall.
You also made a distinction in the study, I believe, between schools that had early spring breaks and later spring breaks, right?
Yes. So that's actually how we identify our effects. So we have the early spring break universities. These students were able to go in spring break, and then they came and returned. And then our comparison group, our counterfactual group, would be the late spring breaks, because these students were not able to go in spring break because their universities canceled classes. So they either did not go in spring break, or they went on spring break, but they returned to their actual home, not to the county of their college campus. What we did find was that by April 30th, early spring break counties or counties with early spring break universities had 20% higher confirmed cases per capita than late spring break counties. So we can say that these early university spring breaks and spring break did contribute significantly to COVID-19 spread in the United States.
Does this data tell us anything about the way, anything that we didn't know already about the way that this disease is transmitted?
So I think this would confirm the ways in which we think this disease is transmitted. So there are many ways in which people think it's transmitted. One would be via breathing, or essentially aerosolization, or I don't want to get too scientific, but essentially breathing in, being in contact with other individuals. Others would be touch and transmission. But this doesn't get that refined in those transfer mechanisms. But this would very much back up just increased social interaction. So abstracting a little bit, bigger picture, we know that more social interaction leads to higher risk for COVID-19 spread. And this is exactly what spring breaks and all these university students are doing. They're gathering in highly congested areas. So if you think about your stereotypical picture of spring break, you have students who might travel to Florida. You're in Florida. So you have students who travel to Florida, and they get jam-packed on beaches, or maybe they go to bars afterwards. And this would confirm a rising concern, which would be the high congestion of adolescents or younger Americans in bars across the U.S., which has led to either the closure or banning of large gatherings or leading to capacity restrictions on bars and restaurants across the United States. So this would confirm that as one of the mechanisms. Also, increased travel. We know that the more individuals travel, the higher risk you become of transmitting or becoming infected yourself. Our SafeGraph data allowed us to trace individuals over time as they travel in spring break, and we're able to see which students fly to their spring break destinations versus other mechanisms of travel like driving. And we actually found that individuals or universities with larger percentage of students who flew to their spring break destination contributed more to COVID-19 spread, which should not be too surprising, because if you're flying while you're going through an airport, you're then on an airplane, you're going to, you know, a further away destination, and these people are contributing more to COVID-19 spread. But this is important because what it shows is that universities, they can do a lot this fall. But one of the things that they can do is they can try to restrict or reduce the necessity of student travel. And one of the ways that they can do this is by altering their academic calendars. And this is something that a lot of universities have already started doing. So if universities do have in-person classes, one thing that they can do is they can cancel all breaks for the fall semester and try to finish up their semester, or at least in-person part of their semester, by Thanksgiving, and then not have students return. Because a big concern for universities is that they have their students go home for fall break or for Thanksgiving break, whatever the university has. And then these students, they go across the United States, especially at a lot of universities that have a more geographically diverse population. They will go across the United States, and then they come back from Thanksgiving, and they can bring a higher risk pool of individuals or higher risk of infection to the local campus area. So one thing that universities can do is cancel all breaks for the fall semester and try to minimize student travel.
I have actually heard of a few schools now that are going to, you know, after Thanksgiving, anything that needs to be done after that is going to be online for the rest of that first semester.
Yes, and that's exactly the case for Ball State University, where I am. And I think that also ties in with an additional concern, which is that a lot of coronavirus-related models are estimating an uptick in cases in the later fall. So they're really trying to knock out two birds with one stone, one of which is decreasing student travel and enhanced social interaction from a more diverse pool than just the local county of the university. And then the other one is that they're trying to really reduce that risk at a time, which is late November, early December, when they are concerned about high risk in general.
Dr. Paul Niekamp is an assistant professor of economics in the Miller College of Business at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Want to change the world, or at least your outlook on it? Try birds. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Doing comforting things virtually has been an important coping method for stress and anxiety. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Trish O'Kane, lecturer in the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Vermont, discusses one way students are learning about the natural world from afar.
Birds are leaders in the growing field of nature therapy. I teach Birding to Change the World, a community-based course which pairs environmental students as birding mentors with children. Pre-COVID, every Wednesday, my students and I spent 3 hours running, birding, and learning with wild children in a wetland. Then my mentors scattered from New York to Hawaii. The kids were locked down at home, and it was impossible to recreate those Wednesdays online. But one day while teaching on Zoom, I heard an Eastern Phoebe calling in a student's Connecticut backyard, and I realized I could identify a bird song through my computer. My students and I began experimenting. It was 41 degrees Fahrenheit in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, at 8:10 a.m. when I took a student and her parents on the first virtual bird walk. They strolled through their neighborhood with a smartphone. I sat at my laptop in Burlington listening to their robins, blue jays, mourning doves, cardinals, Carolina wrens, and the lilting whistle of a white-throated sparrow migrating north. The National Audubon Society helped expand this experiment, matching over 200 Audubon members to 222 freshmen as virtual bird buddies. Watching birds is helping our students cope. Student Sarah Ladd wrote, "The birds show us that the world is still moving, even though we feel at a standstill. Nature continues on, and so must we. Watch birds and see their resiliency. Use that to power you through this, because soon we will fly like the birds and migrate back to campus."
That was Trish O'Kane of the University of Vermont. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.